From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast hosted by Paul Hanley.
Welcome back to the China in the World podcast. This week at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center, we're holding the Carnegie Global Dialogue with our colleagues from the Carnegie Moscow Center. Today, I'm fortunate to be joined on the podcast by two of my close colleagues from Carnegie Moscow Center, Dmitry Trenin, the director, and Alexander, a.k.a. Sasha Gabuev. Listeners of the podcast are familiar with both Dmitry and Alex, who have been on the podcast before. Dmitry is the director of the Carnegie Moscow Center. He's been at the center since the inception back in 1994. Prior to joining Carnegie, he served in the Soviet and Russian armed forces and later held posts as senior research fellow at the Institute of Europe in Moscow and served at the NATO Defense College in Rome. Alex Gabuev is a senior fellow and chair of the Russia and the Asia Pacific program. Started the program at the Carnegie Moscow Center. Prior to joining Carnegie, he's a member of the editorial board of Kommersant Publishing House and served as deputy editor-in-chief of Kommersant Blast. He also served as a diplomatic correspondent in the press corps of then-President Dmitry Medvedev. Both Sasha and Dmitry are here in Beijing this week, as I said, for our Carnegie Global Dialogue, and we explored as part of that dialogue with Chinese experts and scholars on the ground the question that we looked at, which was a question building on 2 years prior of the Carnegie Global Dialogue. 2 years ago, we looked at this question right after President Trump was elected, and it looked like we might perhaps see some improved relations between U.S. and Russia. We looked at this question of what would improved relations between U.S. and Russia mean for the traditional triangular relationship. That was quite fleeting, as we all know. And a year later, we looked at this question of what does Trump's America First policy mean for U.S. relations with Russia, U.S. relations with China, and how does that impact the triangular dynamics of the relationship? This year, with the United States, the Trump administration having put Russia and China as strategic competitors in their national security documents, the national security strategy, the national defense strategy, with U.S.-Russia relations at a real low point, with U.S., the Trump administration putting a lot of pressure on China over trade and economics, and in a number of other areas. We asked the question this year, is U.S. policy, in fact, having the effect of driving China and Russia closer together? Dmitry, before we get to that question, I think it's important for the listeners to understand Russian foreign policy priorities. To start our discussion, I wonder if you could give us a short overview of how you see Russian foreign policy priorities.
Well, I first of all, it's a great opportunity, Paul. Second of all, how I see the priorities perhaps is less important than how I analyze the priorities of the Kremlin. Mm-hmm. The priorities of the Kremlin are as follows, I think. Protect the turf. Protect the areas that are deemed to be vital to Russia's national security. That is Ukraine, that is the former Soviet space, so that those areas do not turn into bases for U.S. military deployments, that those countries do not join NATO, that essentially they form buffer zones along Russia's western and southern frontiers. The second priority, or let's say second in this, not in the order of importance, but I would say equally important, would be asserting Russia's role as a great power, as a global great power, that Russia sees itself as. And third, priority would be standing up to the very significant pressure that the United States and its allies have been putting on Russia as a result of Russia's actions in Ukraine, Crimea, Syria. That, I think, are the three main axes of Russia's foreign policy at this point.
So you have a defensive posture, protecting the turf, a more offensive posture, asserting Russia's role in a more proactive way, as we've seen in the Middle East, other parts of the world, and then standing Russia's ground under the pressure.
Yes, and the standing Russian ground under the pressure also means reaching out to other players around the world that will compensate for the loss of markets in Europe, for the deterioration of Russia's strategic position or strategic relationships with countries such as the United States and countries in NATO. Mm-hmm. And that means diversifying Russia's foreign policy. Russia's foreign policy has pivoted away from the West, certainly from Europe. There's been a pivot not so much to Asia, but to Russia. But having pivoted to itself, the Russian leadership is adopting what I would call a 360 degrees vision of Russia being placed in the center of the great continent of Eurasia, and like sitting in a swivel chair and turning to different opportunities or addressing different threats as they may arise, anywhere they may arise, and treating Europe and China and India and the Muslim world and all others as neighbors in this giant neighborhood.
So as Russia begins to look 360 degrees and diversify its relations and reach out, one of those countries that we've seen an improvement in relations is China. Sasha, you're the Carnegie Moscow Center's resident China hand. How do you see China-Russian relations fitting into Russia's overall foreign policy priorities, as Dmitry laid out? You've engaged Chinese scholars over the last couple days, and you talked very articulately about how you see these four pillars in the China-Russia relationship. Listeners would benefit to hear your analysis on that.
I think that's something, there are several factors that predate the earthquake that Crimea and Ukraine crisis produced for Russian foreign policy and reorientation and pivoting to itself, the way Dmitry puts it. And I think that these four factors or four pillars are the need to protect the border and maintain security and stability along the colossal Russia-China border, then the economic compatibility between the two countries, political compatibility between the two regimes, and then the mutual affinity between the leaders. So if we look at the border, that's the largest border that China has with any country, that's second largest border for Russia, and during the times of Sino-Soviet split, both countries invested a lot of resources in protecting those borders and preparing for foreign invasion. As soon as the opportunity presented itself to normalize these ties and reduce investment into security, both countries jump on that opportunity and right now need to maintain stability along this land space, provides the floor for Sino-Russian relationship. It's not always with each other, but never against each other. And the border really guarantees that this is the formula that works for both. On economic compatibility, I think that Russia as an exporter is mostly about commodities. That's what Russia gives to the outside world. And it really needs markets, capital, both long-term loans and investment, and technology. And traditionally, Russia has been looking for those items in the West, particularly in Europe. But if you look east, China is exactly the same has exactly the same characteristics. And Russia is increasingly putting more eggs into China's basket and diversifying. So the trade structure between Russia and EU and Russia and China is absolutely similar. And it's all logical that Russia tries to increase its footprint in China. On domestic politics, I think neither Russia or China fits into the model which we'll call liberal Western democracy. Both countries are different. They try to manage their domestic politics in a different way. And there is a lot of similarities and room for mutual learning, like when it comes to foreign NGOs or internet freedom, sovereignty. Both countries really put premium on sovereignty and state over the rights of individuals, very broadly defined. And then last point, the leaders, which play an increasingly important role, both in China and in Russia, they are age mates, they have many similarities in their background, and they really want to make their country great again. And they have some sort of suspicions about U.S. intentions when it comes to their regimes and themselves.
So those four pillars, as you lay them out, starting with the resolving the border disputes, which kind of laid the foundation, really, for the two countries to improve their relations. But also on the economic side, there's some symmetries, and the political structures are similar enough, and the relationship is warming between the two leaders. But you also mentioned this week a contradiction, which seems to, in some ways, undercut the those four factors that allow China and Russia to grow stronger together. What is the contradiction in your mind?
I think that the contradiction is the growing asymmetry. Russia used to be on par with China in terms of GDP at the end of the Soviet Union, and like even bigger. Right now, it's smaller than GDP of just one Guangdong province. And I think that that dynamics is continuing. China's growth is 6% or above 6%. Depends on whether you believe Chinese official statistics or not, but that's significant for the economy that size. Russia's for the foreseeable future will be above 1%, and that's it. So this asymmetry and power disparity is growing. China's global leader in AI, robotics, automation, many of the cutting-edge technologies, whereas Russia had some competence, but definitely lacks significantly behind. I think that what's really different is that so far this asymmetry is not really undercutting the relationship, that neither side is trying to use it as a leverage. It does use it in some commercial transactions, but overall, I think that Chinese are very smart in managing Russia as a great power neighbor, managing Russia's ego and understanding that it needs to be treated as a great power with formal respect, and also seeing strategic value in not antagonizing Russia and going for some small short-term win, losing Russia's confidence that it can, you know, have it with China for foreseeable future.
It's really remarkable to think back in the mid-90s, the Russian economy, China economy were largely at parity. And now the Chinese economy is, you mentioned the figure yesterday, how much larger than Russia's?
It's 11 times larger. And
11 times
11
larger.
11 times larger.
And that transition really happened without a lot of increased tension or conflict, which is quite remarkable. Dmitry, I want to turn back to you now that we have a sort of a better understanding of the geopolitical context that China and Russia are operating in. How, in your view, in terms of the penultimate question we've been asking this week, how does the U.S. fit in? And how would you answer the question of that we posed this week at the Carnegie Global Dialogue, is U.S. policy having the effect of driving China and Russia closer together? Of course, I think this would be an unintended effect in the United States. But is, in your view, that dynamic playing out?
Well, I would turn the question into an affirmative statement by inserting just one word, even. So U.S. actions are putting China and Russia even closer together. The dynamic of Sino-Russian rapprochement has sources in both countries. It's not induced by U.S. policies, the rapprochement itself. It started 30 years ago with Gorbachev's visit to Beijing, and it's been processing incrementally, sometimes faster, sometimes slower, over the successive presidents of Russia and successive leaders of China. There is a dynamic that I think will continue to operate in the foreseeable future. What the United States is doing is making Russia and China aware of the of challenges in the international arena that have the same source, and that's the United States. It's one thing for China and Russia to see U.S. Dominance in the world as an issue. Russia in its own way, China in its own way, reject that dominance. But there can be different forms of rejection. There can be different forms of asserting one's own role on the world arena. The U.S. Official documents that you mentioned at the beginning, the U.S. National Security Strategy and the U.S. National Defense Strategy, are sending a similar message to both Beijing and Moscow, that Washington sees them as strategic competitors, also military competitors. And in my own judgment, this competition has entered a new territory that I would call rivalry, and for China, and confrontation for Russia and the United States. So that puts a premium on, bigger premium than otherwise would have been the case, on Sino-Russian defense and security collaboration. And China and Russia also have to, well, take precautions in case they face a challenge more or less at the same time through the actions of the United States. For example, if we can imagine various scenarios of the Korean Peninsula developments. And China and Russia, for the first time in the decade of their cooperation in the form of joint military exercises, have actually trained their forces in a real major war scenario. Not a peacekeeping mission, not a mission to thwart terrorist or radical raids in some part of the world, part of Asia, such as Central Asia. But China took part in a major Russian military exercise of a strategic scale that involved one-third of Russia's armed forces personnel. Mm-hmm. And clearly that exercise had the United States as a potential enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not suggesting that China and Russia are close or will be close in the foreseeable future to concluding a military alliance. I don't think this is on the cards.
Mm-hmm.
However, the two countries are certainly practicing interoperability in case they have to collaborate in a real security crisis. What do they do? I think this is significant. And frankly, in my view, the United States has discounted Russia, also in military terms, quite a lot in the last couple of decades, or three decades. And it has not attached enough significance to Sino-Russian military cooperation. And talking about strategy, I see U.S. policy toward Eurasia writ large as eminently non-strategic.
Dmitry, you've answered the question by saying basically that Russia and China relations naturally are growing stronger even without the United States, but the U.S. policies are bringing them even closer together. We talked a lot, Sasha, on the panel yesterday about, despite that fact, there are limitations and to how far this growing relationship can go. On the podcast last spring, Sasha, you talked about the seemingly one-sided nature of the China-Russia relationship, heavily tilted towards China. And I wanted to ask you, you know, how you see, what influence does that have in your view on the relationship? Do you expect this imbalance to lessen over time or grow more intense? And how would that impact the China-Russia relationship?
I would add just one more line on why the U.S. Policy towards Russia and China is so important in driving the two together. Like, all these four pillars pre-existed, and it's literally in both countries' national interest to cooperate. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there were some lingering fears and risks attached to partnership with China. And I think what happened after Crimea, which is really overlooked in the West, is that for the first time, as Russia was cut off from the capital markets in the wake of sectorial sanctions, and I think that the prospects, because the hostilities, the hot war in Ukraine was still ongoing, and nobody knew back then where it will lead, the Russian government was looking at all kind of sanction scenario, including really tough Iranian style of sanctions. Like, people talked back then of cutting Russia off SWIFT, mm-hmm. and many other options. And Russia, for the first time, needed to look into alternatives, and mm-hmm. China popped up as the major potential partner. But like, what about risks? Mm-hmm. And that was for the first time in my memory that Russian government, in a pretty meticulous way, went through many risks attached. Like, what about Chinese population in the Far East? What about Chinese theft of Russian military secrets? What about Chinese presence in Central Asia? And going through all of these risks, the Russian government established that, hey, either they're overhyped, like these risks probably existed in the 90s, but they don't exist anymore, or that there are like nothing we can do about it risks, mm-hmm. like Chinese growing economic footprint in Central Asia. I think Russian government for the first time came up with the idea that China's rise is not of a threat to Russia. Russia can manage it. It's not a direct security challenge. And we know that we can operate this landscape as a second-tier player and player we can have, but with a lot of confidence. I think that's really important, which gave Russia much more confidence in opening up its economy to China. So the question for Russia really is that, not that, oh, the balance of power is tilting towards China. That's understandable. And I think that many increasing number of members of the Russian elite are okay with living with that. So though it's tough, Russia has been the elder brother of China during communist times, and now it's different. But I think that the question is getting more pragmatic. What benefits do we get for my company, for my country, in the future out of this relationship? And I think that Russians get to the idea that the deal that you can cut with China today is better than the deal you can cut tomorrow. And tomorrow is better than the deal you can cut the day after tomorrow, just because of this tilting balance of power.
Interesting. For the last question, I want to ask you something that you might not get asked often. I look very closely, of course, at the U.S.-China relationship, and I'm sure both of you do as well. But I want to ask you about the U.S.-China relationship as Russian experts. Dmitry, many Chinese these days, given the pressure from the United States of the tariffs, which President Trump seems to be cranking up, given the speech that Vice President Pence gave recently, where he laid out a litany of grievances with China, including the South China Sea issues, and even talking about China as trying to interfere in U.S. elections. This is all culminated in leaving many Chinese asking me the question, are we moving towards a Cold War with the United States? Is the U.S. trying to contain us? Dmitry, you lived during the Cold War. You served as a Soviet Army colonel in the Cold War. as someone who has lived in the Cold War and knows what a Cold War is and what a Cold War is not, how would you answer that question?
You know, when Russian forces went into Crimea in February 2014, I started using the terminology of the Cold War. I actually saw it as the beginning of a new Cold War between Russia and the West. However, after a few months, I stopped doing that, not because the situation had improved, it had deteriorated, but because I came to the conclusion that if we use the terminology starting with the word itself, the phrase Cold War, then we will be misleading ourselves and those who are listening to us, because with the Cold War memories imprinted and once somebody on the back of somebody's mind, will be expecting things to happen that will not happen because the world has changed, and we'll be missing new things that will happen or are happening already, but we'll be missing them that didn't exist in the Cold War. Again, the world has changed. So to me, the terminology of a Cold War, unless you you basically use it as a phrase to denote a certain deterioration of relations, that is not helpful. Mm-hmm. I think China and the United States are still at the point where they have a rivalry in their relations. I hope that that rivalry does not reach the pitch of confrontation, which it has reached in relations between the United States and Russia. It will be too bad for the world if the world's two most powerful nations, two most powerful economies, find themselves in confrontation. That'll be a disaster for the whole world. So I would rather talk about intense rivalry between a rivalry that gets more intense between the United States. Mm-hmm. It still can't be managed, and hopefully it can be brought back to the stage which is normal, in my view, among the major powers, the stage of competition. I also hope that at some point the confrontation between Russia and the United States, that for which I have a phrase that is reminiscent of the Cold War and yet is markedly different from the Cold War, I call it hybrid war, just to use the popular expression, that can also be mitigated. First of all, protected from getting from the cold phase to a hot phase. And I think we have a military deconfliction that saves us from the worst. But eventually, I very much hope, dearly hope, that we can also go back to just competition between the United States and Russia. And the difference in national power, national economic or military or other potentials, is not that does not preclude countries competing against one another in various areas in various parts of the world.
You've written extensively on this hybrid war concept, which you, I think, coined the term. I'd encourage our listeners to go back and read your writings on this. I find it very compelling. Sasha, you, different than Dmitry, who served as a Soviet colonel in the Cold War, you were born on the day that Gorbachev was sworn in as Secretary General of the Communist Party in 1985. So you have actually lived most of your life in the post-Cold War era. And I wonder if you, in answering that question, looking at U.S.-China, are we drifting into a Cold War? Would you answer differently than Dmitry, given your background?
I think that part of my background is also that I graduated with a major in classic Chinese history. My diploma was on bronze inscriptions in Dongzhou. And I think that my view is very much informed looking at history. and trying to look parallels for today's growing tensions between China and the US, and reading Vice President Pence's speech, I hope that it's not driving us into a conflict between the two systems, because that's what's very different from the time of Cold War, where it was communism against capitalism and democracy. I think that China has, with large state domination, a pretty similar economic setup with all the different policies and the oversized role that the state plays here, but it's still a market, and people can travel, people can easily communicate, and the life is so much more similar in the US and China than it was in the Soviet Union and in the West. And the worrying tendency in Vice President Pence's speech is to frame China as a very different system. So it's not only about Made in China 2025, it's not about theft of intellectual property, but it's about just being an evil for what's happening in the Chinese politics. And the analogy I would use is the pre-World War I world. That's where the countries were so intertwined, the economies were so intertwined, like Germany was the largest trading partner for Great Britain and vice versa. The families were, the royal families were interconnected. Russian emperor was cousin of the German Kaiser. The elites were so intertwined in cultural terms, like much more probably than US and China elites. And had the leaders of the countries known back in 1912, 1911, 1913, that the decisions that they are making are leading the world into the disaster which will destroy half of Europe, and whether there is a diplomatic way to sort out the very similar contradictions about trade imbalances or colonies or sphere of influence, of course nobody would gone to this confrontational mode. And I think that this is something that the leaders on both sides should be very carefully studying, because it incrementally happens that we drive into this very disastrous confrontation mode.
So your suggestion is something to the effect of, instead of making it ideological, going after the Chinese system and saying they need a overhaul of the system, go after the specific cases where the way they do business is creating distortions in the global system, or on the trade and economic issues in the global economic space, maybe Chinese industrial policies or the fact that Chinese markets remain closed off to foreign competition. Go after those more specifically as opposed to going after the system.
Right. And my advice would be to go that in private setup with the Chinese government, as opposed to take it out in the public realm and sort of really limiting the space for domestic maneuvering here, because that definitely creates some ruptures here in the domestic structure and vice versa. So that would be my humble advice.
Well, I find it extremely useful to get your advice as Russian experts on the U.S.-China relationship, kind of an outside perspective. Sometimes when you are stuck in the middle of it, it's good to get outside perspectives. And I appreciate you joining the China in the World podcast. I especially appreciate you traveling from Moscow to be in Beijing with us this week for the Carnegie Global Dialogue. And we look forward to having you back again. Thank you.
Always a pleasure to see the Beijing branch of our big Carnegie clan. Carnegie Jiatian.
Well, that's it for China in the World. That's it for this edition of the Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast. I encourage you to explore our site and see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in next time.